We are continuing our series in the Gospel of Matthew. But first, I want to talk about the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is the fourth book of the Bible. And it's said that it corresponds to the teenage years of the new nation of faith that God had created when he freed the Israelites from slavery in Egypt. The teenage years. What are some of the characteristics of the teenage years? Well, there's questioning, there's rebellion. Adolescents in general are unsure of what they believe, and they often parrot convictions of others. They struggle in relationships, treating each other with alternating doses of sympathy and cruelty. These experiences are found in abundance in the book of Numbers. Now, the fourth section of the Gospel of Matthew, see, we got back to Matthew, seems to match the book of Numbers, just as the previous sections in Matthew corresponded to Genesis, Exodus, and Leviticus, respectively. So here we are in the fourth section, and there's definitely a feeling of adolescent spirituality. And by the way, when I say adolescent spirituality, this is not based on chronological age. I've known teenagers who are rather mature in their faith, and I've known many adults who are adolescent in theirs. One such adolescent was Peter, one of the disciples of Jesus. Having already witnessed the public miracle of the feeding of thousands of people with just five loaves and two fish, he then catches sight of Jesus walking on the Sea of Galilee during an early morning storm. Like an impulsive kid, he shouts out, "Hey, let me try that." And so Jesus tells him to come out. And to everybody's astonishment, he steps out and he's walking on the water just like Jesus. But then he starts to realize what he is doing, takes his eyes off of Jesus. He feels the wind, he sees the waves, he begins to sink. Help! Michael Green comments on this. This was an important story for the Christian community for which Matthew wrote. It was a pattern both of unbelief and of faith. They were called to go to Jesus to direct their lives to the walk of faith, but storms often beset them and fear chilled them. In his power, they could for a while do what would otherwise have been impossible, until they considered what they were doing and reflected on the size of the waves. Then, of course, they would begin to sink until they cried out to the Son of God for his powerful hand to catch them up and hold them. This is what the story would have been used for and what it is still used for today. By the end of this story, Peter is an example both of little faith and doubt. He has become an object lesson for the other disciples. Do not take your eyes off of Jesus. Don't be distracted by what you think is distressing circumstances surrounding you. But what I think really shows the adolescence of Peter is found in an incident that is commonly referred to as the Great Confession. It's found in chapter 16, the Great Confession. Jesus and the disciples come to a place called Caesarea Philippi. Jesus asks his disciples what other people are saying of him. Some, like Herod, say, it's John the Baptist come back to life. And he probably said that because his guilt was haunting him. He was the one who killed John. Others thought that maybe Jesus is the returned prophet Elijah, one of the greatest prophets of the Old Testament, who himself is prophesied to be the forerunner of the Messiah. And still others wouldn't commit to a particular prophet. They just said, well, he's definitely got a message from God. All right, that's what other people were saying. Then Jesus looks at his own followers, he looks at his disciples and asks, and you, what are you saying about me? Who do you think I am? And I imagine there was this awkward silence for a bit. And thoughts got into people's heads, and some of them maybe they wanted to say, but they were afraid to say. But Peter breaks the silence, makes this great discovery and confession, you are the Christ, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now Jesus congratulates him, and one can almost imagine the peanut gallery. I know there was no peanut gallery there, but just go play with it, okay? And they hear what has happened, and so they're shouting along with everybody else, hey, Peter, you did great. This is wonderful, fantastic. You hit the nail on the head, okay? So he's really riding high until Jesus explains what it means. That he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed. And on the third day be raised. How does Peter respond? Open rebellion. Open rebellion to what Jesus has just said. This is in spite of the fact of what Peter just declared about this Jesus, in spite of the fact that he had seen Jesus teach with authority, heal the sick, send away evil spirits. He fed thousands of people with 5 loaves and 2 fish and even walked on water. He suddenly acts like Jesus is the biggest idiot on the planet. No. That ain't gonna happen. Forget about that, Jack. Okay, that's not an exact quote, you understand? But those of you who have ever had a teenager in your household know exactly what I'm talking about. It seems like as soon as they turn 13, it happens. As soon as they enter that phase, they think you got to be the dumbest person to ever walk the planet, right? And if you're a parent, sooner or later, you're going to find yourself saying this phrase. You wonder where it comes from. You're going to say, do you think I'm stupid? Now, you can't help it. It just sort of falls out of your mouth, right? It was probably some mindless rhetorical remark that maybe your parents used on you. Do you think I'm stupid? Well, you can all imagine the situations where you're going to say something like that. You ask for something where they should know where it is, and they say, I have no idea. Or you ask why they didn't answer the phone call when you call them. They have no idea. They feign ignorance. So when it comes to the question, it's not rhetorical for them. The answer is yes, you are stupid. You are very stupid. You've reached the point in your parenting life when you've gone from being the hero to being the tedious fool. Congratulations. Well, I've been through it twice. And again, I'm exaggerating a little bit. Not every teenager is like this. Some are just more clever about it and hiding what they really think. But I have good news for you. It doesn't last. Eventually they come around. Eventually they start thinking that maybe you know a thing or two. For me, it was when they came around and asked me to co-sign a loan. Suddenly, I was the smart dad. I was the good dad. So how does Jesus respond to Peter's adolescence? How does he respond to this rebellion? Well, pretty severely. And it's clear that he's not only just speaking to Peter, he wants to be overheard by the other disciples, because they're probably thinking the same thing that Peter was thinking. The severity, the harshness of the rebuke arises from Jesus' recognition in Peter's attempt to dissuade him from the cross, the same temptation that Jesus experienced at the beginning of his ministry. In the temptation account, we read that Satan offered Jesus the option of using the world's means for accomplishing Jesus' mission. On that occasion, Jesus flatly rejected that option. "Beat it, Satan," he said. Then he backed his rebuke with a third quote from the book of Deuteronomy: "Worship the Lord your God, and only him, serve him with absolute single-heartedness." So apparently Jesus recognizes in Peter some of the same deviousness that was in Satan. So much to Peter's chagrin, he hears these words coming out of Jesus' mouth to him: "Get behind me, Satan." There's no way to twist that into a friendly remark. And the follow-up makes it clear: "You are a stumbling block to me, for you are setting your mind not on divine things, but on human things." This may have been a double shock for Peter. Shocked that Jesus would speak so harshly to him, but also shocked that he's suddenly on the wrong side of the divine will. See, Peter had in mind what so many people of his day had in mind: a popular messiahship with human goals and human means to achieve those goals. Whereas God had in mind something far more significant and lasting, something that only a creator could accomplish. And we seem to be a lot like Peter, don't we? We let our ideas and our expectations get in the way of what God is trying to do. All right, we have a collection of teachings here in section 4. And those of you who have been following the series know that it is these collections that mark off the different sections in Matthew. So here's the fourth collection, and it's in chapter 18. And this chapter is under the theme of relationships, or how to get along with others. Now, teenagers struggle with this, but so do adults. Jesus asserts a vital attitude for disciples if they want to get along with others, and that attitude is humility. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" He called a child whom he put among them and said, "Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes humble like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me." Any civilization, any human society that has existed has been concerned about establishing what we might call a pecking order. A pecking order. The Gospels record several disputes among the disciples on this very topic. Who is the greatest? Over against all conventional ideas of status and importance, Jesus offers the model of the little child. Now, to understand this, you must realize that children in antiquity were of little account. I've heard many a well-meaning sermon on this passage, in which I've been told that I need to be like a child, and that means to have the childlike qualities of innocence or unselfishness. Now, I love children. Children are a gift from God. But anyone who claims that children are innocent and unselfish has never had any children. Innocent. And besides, that is not the point of the passage. The point that Jesus is making has to do with the status of the child. And what was the status of the child? At the very bottom of the social order. Jesus is saying, you want to be great? Go to the bottom. You want to be great? Humble yourself. Treat the least prominent person as the most important. If you do that, you will have welcomed me. I can imagine the disciples trying to talk to Jesus about this. Are you crazy? If people did that, we'd turn the world upside down. And Jesus replies, nah, you're catching on. Check out Acts 17, verse 6. Perhaps the thing that most affects our relationships is that we tend to hurt each other. All the time. Even people we care a great deal about, we tend to hurt each other. So it's not a surprise that most of this chapter 18 is about mercy and forgiveness. It's a big lesson to learn. It ends with the parable of the unforgiving servant. And the words are haunting. Now, ancient rabbis taught that you should forgive someone three times. So if you sin a fourth time against someone, well, you're out of luck. You're not going to be forgiven. Too bad. And this was based on a misunderstanding of the book of Amos, okay? And in the beginning of the book of Amos, Amos has these series of indictments, these series of condemnations, in which he uses the stock phrase, for three transgressions and for four, blah, 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 blah. Well, the ancient rabbis thought, well, if God is not going to forgive on the fourth time, why should we? So that's how they arrived at the number three, but again, it's a misunderstanding of Amos. So Peter sets the stage for this last parable in this section. He asks Jesus, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Now, Peter has hung around with Jesus for a little bit. You know, some of these things are kind of rubbing off, and he thinks he's picked up a thing or two. In fact, he's feeling a little bit cocky at this point, because he suggests an answer. And oh my, you can almost see it on his face. He thinks this answer is going to impress the socks off of Jesus. I mean, this answer is so incredibly generous, no one would even have thought of it before. How many times should I forgive my sister or my brother? As many as seven times? And you can picture him just waiting for the accolades to come. But darn it, Jesus is not impressed. He says, no. 77 times. Which, by the way, is not to be taken literally. It's a figure of speech, meaning no limits. Ooh. Seven seems awful minuscule now, doesn't it? Jesus then tells the parable of the servant forgiven a great debt who went out and dealt mercilessly with a fellow servant who owed him a debt that was only a tiny fraction of his own debt. And because he was merciless, was utterly condemned. Well, the parable underscores a theme that runs through the New Testament. And that is, there's a relationship between offering mercy and receiving it. There's a relationship between offering mercy and receiving it. Jesus said, "Blessed are the merciful, for they will obtain mercy." Paul writes, "Bear with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other, just as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also must forgive." But forgiveness is hard, especially if it involves people close to you. There's an old ditty, you've probably heard it. It goes something like this. "To dwell above with saints we love, oh, that will be glory. But to dwell below with saints we know, well, that's another story." We need to forgive as we have been forgiven. We need to show mercy as we have been shown mercy. We need to love as we have been loved. Ray Stedman observes, "Can we not forgive $20 worth of injury when we have been forgiven 10 million ourselves? That is always our situation. Therefore, if there's a grudge, if we have been harboring resentment, if there is a feeling of antipathy, if we do not want to speak to someone else, if we feel cut off from another, two things have happened. We have reacted as an ungrateful wretch to the grace that has been extended to us, just like the unforgiving servant did. And second, we have consigned ourselves to bitterness of heart, to the eating of the acid of resentment, to our own hurt. This is why nothing will ever take place toward the healing of the world until there is the healing of the church." The healing of the heart, the healing of hurts one with another, by the grace and mercy God has shown us.